Welcome to this podcast from the Medical Journal of Australia. My name is Sam Hunt, the MJA's news and online editor. Today we are discussing improving the health and well-being of Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander children across Australia. My special guest is Professor Fiona Stanley, a prominent epidemiologist known for her public health work and her research into Indigenous health. Professor Stanley trained as a medical doctor at the University of Western Australia. She is a distinguished professorial fellow in the School of Paediatrics and Child Health at the University of Western Australia. She is patron of the Telethon Kids Institute, where she was the founding director. Professor Stanley, thank you so much for joining me today.
Thank you very much for having me, Sam.
Professor Stanley, let me start by asking you, how do you see the state of Indigenous well-being and health at the moment?
Well, I think it's very variable because you have often people see pictures and data from remote communities, but only 20% of Aboriginal people live in remote communities and their health on the whole is very bad. Some of them not so bad, but they have high rates of things like rheumatic heart disease and diabetes and high blood pressure and those sorts of complications, high rates of maternal mental health problems and suicides. When you look at some of the health outcomes within cities, and you have outcomes that are much better. But the interesting thing is that even Aboriginal people within cities close to the best health services in the world have poor outcomes, much poorer outcomes compared with non-Indigenous people. But it is variable. The one thing I am worried about, though, is the well-being. And I think this is why I think the voice is so important, because it will address our self-esteem as well as all the other things that we're going to talk about.
And let me ask you about the Closing the Gap initiatives and what you see to be working and not working.
I have a problem with Closing the Gap, actually, and the way it's analysed. If you compare one non-Indigenous population with an Indigenous population, I mean, it's very false. There aren't two populations. There are a variety of Indigenous populations and a variety of non-Indigenous populations. And the best way to analyse these data would be to actually analyse within Aboriginal populations those people who are doing very well compared with those people who are not. But if you do have just the comparison and look at the gap, it's not going well. Some of that's due to the fact that whilst Aboriginal rates for things like infant mortality are actually improving, they're not improving as fast as those for non-Indigenous kids. So, in fact, the gap is still there. The things that worry me are things like year 12 retentions, which are incredibly important and predictive of later problems in Aboriginal children. So I think it's important to have Closing the Gap, but we have to look at it more intelligently, I think.
And let's unpack why some of those Closing the Gap initiatives are not working.
There are two major reasons why Australian governments have not had effect on Closing the Gap. The first major set of reasons is that governments implement projects without Aboriginal voices, which in fact either cost a lot of money and are useless or cost a lot of money and are damaging. And the best example of that is the Northern Territory intervention set up to reduce child sexual abuse in the Northern Territory in response to the Little Children Are Sacred report. And every year after that expensive punitive intervention, child sexual abuse went up. The second major reason is that what we were going to talk about, which is the incredible success of Aboriginal community-controlled organisations in influencing the health and well-being, particularly, I think, because of my bias, in Aboriginal children, mothers, families. And what happens with governments is they defund them or underfund them or don't value them. And that's happened. The worst example of that happened is the Aboriginal-controlled early childhood centres, 70 of them that existed around Australia funded by the Commonwealth Government. And in 2015, Abbott, Turnbull, Scullion and Birmingham defunded them. Now, we know the evidence for early childhood intervention is overwhelming. So we tried very hard to get that reversed, but it didn't happen. And now people are wondering why all these kids are going off the rails all over the place. So, you know, it is a lot of evidence now to show that if Aboriginal communities, Aboriginal community-controlled organisations are given a voice and funding, they will make a huge difference. The best example is COVID.
Yes, and let's talk about the COVID-19 pandemic and what happened in Indigenous communities and perhaps the importance of self-led initiatives.
It was remarkable. You know, and all your listeners will know, that the Aboriginal communities in every country in the world were at very high risk from COVID. They had chronic disease, they lived in poor circumstances, they have low health literacy. You know, they'd already, the Australian Aboriginal doctors and Aboriginal health professionals knew about H1N1 flu in 2009, how devastating it was for the Aboriginal population. They swung into action from NACHO, the National Aboriginal Community Controlled Organisation in Canberra, headed up by Pat Turner, right down to local communities, including remote communities. They swung into action and demanded the interventions that would protect their communities. They wanted testing, they wanted masks, they wanted health care, you know, telehealth. They wanted to close the communities. Across the nation, partnerships were set up between the Aboriginal medical services and other health services, other welfare services, because if you're closing communities, you've got to provide healthcare, you've got to provide food, you've got to provide all of these things. And it's extraordinary what happened between 2020 and 2021, to the end of 2021. Aboriginal people had 6 times fewer cases than we did. That's a complete reversal of the gap. There were no deaths. There was one person in intensive care, and there were no cases after the Black Lives Matter marches. By the end of 2021, when they started to roll out the vaccines, they didn't take the right advice from the voice. They opened the communities too soon, and they stuffed up the vaccine rollout. It was then more cases happened. But still, if you look at other colonised Aboriginal populations around the world, this was the best result in the world. I mean, they were better than us. And I wish I could have got this out more into the media, but somehow they didn't like the story. And, you know, it is the most remarkable evidence for giving a voice to Aboriginal people and letting them implement the services in partnership that were going to make the biggest difference to their outcomes. It is a superb example of a voice.
Let's turn to now a study done by the Telethon Institute, the West Australia Aboriginal Child Health Survey, which received an enormous participation rate and really showed that the Indigenous population trusted the Telethon Institute to share their issues. But really, this study uncovered enormous issues with forcible removals, which impacted multiple generations.
Oh, I'm so glad you asked this question, because this was an incredible survey. There's not been one like it anywhere else in the world in any Indigenous population, to my knowledge. But in 2003, the Institute, and it was a fabulous team headed up by Steve Zubrick and Sven Silburn, Ken Wyatt was involved, Ted Wilkes, a whole group of Aboriginal people, including interviewers. But usually when you go out and do a survey, you know, you might be lucky to get 60, 70% participation. We got 90%. And that was across 12,000 families and children and their parents and grandparents and carers across the whole of Western Australia, in every community and town and city. It was an extraordinary response rate, because Aboriginal people trusted us to listen to their stories and to do something about it. And we looked at the extent to which these families reported forced removals of grandparents, parents, and between 40 and 60% of all ATSIC regions in Western Australia reported stolen generations. So it was a truly stolen generation. But what was remarkable was when we looked at the children whose families reported being stolen compared with those which weren't, not just first generational effects, not just second generational effects, but third generations and continuing to today, the impact was enormous. They had 2 or 3 times the rates of mental health problems, substance abuse, gambling, and even birth weight was affected, lower birth weights in the group who had the history of being stolen. It was a devastating impact. And I always say, actually, Sam, that if we had this kind of thing happen to us, we would have the same outcomes as they do. So it's not an Aboriginal problem. It's actually a marginalisation, genocide, you know, cultural genocide problem. And for people to say that we have to get over it now, you know, that was years ago, today we are still seeing the impact on children, on families of this stolen generation. So it was a very important study. It's interesting that when we produced the first results, the Canberra bureaucrats didn't believe it, so we had to reanalyse the entire data set and then present it in other papers.
So to give our audience a bit more background, you've dedicated your career to research into child health and Aboriginal child health. From your perspective, how important is it to get the settings right in early childhood to ensure that people have the best chance of health during their life and taking into account the social determinants of health?
I just don't understand how so many of the bureaucrats and politicians that we've been lobbying over the last 30 years don't understand the causal pathways, the pathways to almost all the poor outcomes in our lives, Indigenous, not Indigenous, commence probably before conception, but certainly during pregnancy and in the early years of life. And overwhelmingly, this poor outcomes arise in poor socioeconomic circumstances. So your chances of having a healthy and successful life where you can participate in society depend on who your mother is, how educated she is, where she lives, the circumstances in which she lives, and whether she's married or not. That is the most important predictors of how you're going to be, because the kinds of mothers and families that live in poor circumstances cannot provide the kinds of environments that are for the future health of their children. Now, we know that in the whole of society, it's across the board. It's not just in the marginalised Aboriginal people, but in the Aboriginal populations around the world, it is huge. The impact is huge. And that's why I get very excited about the power of turning that around by providing early childhood services, particularly those run by Aboriginal people, for these populations. I mean, we've been lobbying governments for 30 years about this. I mean, the world knows about early childhood. They know its impact. The best investment of any nation is to invest in early childhood, because you will reduce all of the problems. You'll improve health, you'll reduce deaths, you'll improve mental health, you'll get kids ready for school. The kids that go through school do well. They don't do criminal behaviour. They don't get into detention. You know, they don't suicide. I mean, and then they become successful parents, teachers, workplace. I mean, so if you want a healthy workplace for the future, invest in the socioeconomic determinants of health in early childhood, in pregnancy and early childhood. It's so clear. All the data are there for every nation, for every population. Can you understand my anguish that people don't understand this? And they lock kids up with fetal alcohol syndrome at the age of 10 because they're committing crimes, not asking, why would a 10-year-old commit this crime? What's their early life chances been? So it's in a way, I'm very excited about this, because it will solve any problems. It will reduce the health budget, the justice budget, the child protection budget, you know. Anyway, I could go on, and I should not, because I'm meant to be brief, but you can understand my anguish.
Absolutely. And let's talk about how the Indigenous Voice to Parliament will help improve consultation at a government level. I recently interviewed Professor Ian Anderson in Tasmania. He's the former Deputy Secretary of the Department of Prime Minister and Cabinet. And he gave that government perspective of how government consultation is carried out in tiny microcosms of government policy in smaller areas. But if one provides feedback on an area a government is not consulting in, then it's out of scope. Can you talk to me how an Indigenous Voice to Parliament will look across all these areas, all of this affecting Aboriginal wellbeing?
Absolutely. Just to comment on that, it's a very important point that Ian made, because that consultation process of microcosm consultation with Aboriginal people is given as an excuse for not funding the holistic, total Aboriginal controlled services, which would have made such a difference if they had been properly funded for the last 2 or 3 decades. So it's a very important point, because what happens then with that kind of consultation is nothing gets funded, or the white bureaucrats keep on getting paid for delivering something which is either useless or harmful. So it's a very good point that Ian made. Why I'm so excited about The Voice is that it will actually be a very important transmission of what Indigenous people need from all of the communities, all of the people living in cities, etc., into a group of people in Canberra. And people are saying, oh, how can this work with this elite group in Canberra? All of the groups with whom I'm working, and that is in health, in the legal services, in child protection, and in education, Aboriginal controlled organisations have a network. It's a phenomenal network. And the latest network is the Birthing on Country network, which is incredibly exciting. So there is already this transmission of information across these wonderful networks. The trouble is that they are not listened to at every level of government. So what's so exciting for me about The Voice is that it will actually improve outcomes very quickly, because you have to put The Voice in place, get the evidence from your Aboriginal people about, and they all know how well Aboriginal controlled organisations work. They know. And it's getting that kind of messages through to their group in Canberra, who will then give this advice to government. I mean, the whole thing is quite weak when you think about it. I would like it to be much more binding. I'd like that Aboriginal voice to say, we've got to do this, otherwise you will be punished, but we can't say that. It's the most beautiful invitation to Australians to actually vote for this. The other thing is, of course, is that it will absolutely lead to an incredible increase in self-esteem amongst First Nations people. And I've had evidence of that time and time again. When you have Aboriginal voices being heard and Aboriginal people being employed, and we've employed so many of them, the self-esteem goes through the roof. So that has a major impact on all their mental health and their physical health and reduction of suicides in their children, all those sort of things. So, you know, I think that people can criticise the Voice for not being enough, and there's lots of things, but this is an amazing opportunity to reverse the gap outcomes that we've been talking about.
And Professor Stanley, finally, I just want to ask you, you were named Australian of the Year in 2003, and the Fiona Stanley Hospital was named in your honour in 2014. Can I ask you, what is it like to have that level of recognition for the work that you've done?
Well, it's a great honour. They're both great honours. I must confess that I used the Australian of the Year award to unashamedly lobby for Aboriginal disparity research and early childhood. And we were very successful in that year. We organised it like a military campaign. And I used the hospital as well all the time. I introduced myself to people. I say, I'm Fiona Stanley. And they say, oh, Fiona Stanley Hospital. I say, yes. And what I want you to do is to understand this or look at our data and do that. I'm unashamedly using them to further our work. But it's just been the most rewarding career. And I'll just tell you quickly that all of the research that I've done with my Aboriginal colleagues has changed my life. I went to them when we set up the institute. I went to the Aboriginal community. I said, what do you want us to be for you? Because we're a research institute, not a service provider. And the Aboriginal community said, we want you to be our mother. And what does a mother do? She gives power to her kids and funding and knowledge so that they can cope with a really challenging world out there. So we've had cohort after cohort of these bright Aboriginal people who have now got PhDs, they've got professorships, they're all around the nation. Now, this is what I know. I know that this is happening. I know that there are so many competent Aboriginal scholars and Aboriginal people and health professionals and others out there, but people don't know this. There are lots of Australians who don't know any Aboriginal people, and they just look at the stereotypes. But I have been so privileged to have worked with this group of people who have taught me different ways of doing research, different understandings of how important culture and country are to the Aboriginal health and well-being of their populations. And, you know, we have so much to learn. When I was doing the interview with Norman Swan and Donna Archie, Donna was describing what the Aboriginal Health Service looked like. And Norman Swan said, gee, we'd all like a health service like that, wouldn't we? So I may be considered to be an idealistic radical, but I do believe that the Aboriginal ways of doing things, which we've researched so thoroughly over the last 40 years, are really important for all of us, not just for Aboriginal people.
Professor Fiona Stanley, thank you so much for joining me today.
It's been my pleasure, and I hope everyone likes this podcast.
Professor Fiona Stanley is a prominent epidemiologist known for her public health work and her research into Indigenous health. She trained as a medical doctor at the University of Western Australia. Professor Stanley is patron of the Telethon Kids Institute, where she was founding director, and she was Australian of the Year in 2003. You can find more podcasts on our website at mja.com.au or wherever you get your podcasts. Thank you so much for listening.